Hello and welcome to the Multiplanetary Society podcast, where we explore topics related to the space economy and the why and how of potentially becoming a multiplanetary species. I'm your host, Timothy Reuter. Today we are pleased to have with us Dr. Christopher Mason. Dr. Mason is something of a polymath, serving as professor of physiology and biophysics at Weill Cornell Medicine, director of the WorldQuant Initiative for Quantitative Prediction, and professor of neuroscience at the Brain and Mind Institute. In his free time, he's managed to author multiple books, including The Next 500 Years, which will be the main topic of our conversation, and The Age of Prediction, which we will touch upon briefly. Dr. Mason, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. Pleasure to be here.
One of the things that attracted me to your work was that you make a very clear case for why you think we have a moral obligation to become a multiplanetary species and an agenda for how to accomplish that. So let's start there. Why do you think we need to become a multiplanetary and possibly a multi-solar system species?
Yeah, to me, that it really is built on just a fundamental fact that I think all ethical questions become crystal clear through the lens of about 1 billion years. So if your time frame is years, decades, weeks, you can have a lot of vagaries and priorities. But as I think probably most, as you know, and most of your listeners probably know, in about a billion years, the sun will start to boil the oceans. In 5 billion years, the sun will engulf the earth. And so that means that no matter how extraordinary our progress technologically, sociologically, culturally, everything we do here on this planet, which is wonderful, will all go away if we're still here. So it's just a fundamental cosmic fact that we cannot physically stay here forever. And so if that's the case and you value life, so you have two principles. If life has value, which I believe it does, and I think most people do, and it's going to die if we don't move it, then we, by definition, we have to move it. And that's syllogism. We have got no choice. So that's a tactical question. But the ethical part is there is no other entity in the universe, that, as far as we know, that has the capacity for understanding extinction. It is only humans that have this awareness so far. Maybe we'll find other creatures or build them, or AI might acquire it someday. But so far, we're the only ones with the awareness of extinction, and therefore the only ones that can act to prevent it, including our own, but also serve as really stewards and shepherds for all of life. And I think we have a duty to do so because we're the only ones that can see it so far.
Yeah. So I want to take a few more minutes to examine the question of the why before we get to the how.
Sure.
Something that I don't think you addressed in the book is the question of urgency. So given that some of the issues you talk about are millions or perhaps even billions of years away, and your plan is for 500 years, why not simply wait a few millennia for technology to improve and focus on expanding human presence at that point?
Great question. So I talk about it briefly in the book, is that there's a lot of critiques of either it's too far away or that there's other priorities. There's, you know, there's poverty, there's different diseases. And no, I think there's two answers to that. One is that we can do both at the same time. So it's a false dichotomy to say we can only do urgent problems, but not faraway problems, because we, you know, passed civil rights legislation and put people on the moon in the same decade. We know we can walk and chew gum as a species at the same time. It's okay. But then also, even though it seems far away, that's assuming nothing else goes wrong, right? That we don't have an asteroid hit the Earth or some other large-scale pandemic that could be worse, or that we have some other calamity that happens that we couldn't predict, which, you know, the asteroids continually hit the Earth and have throughout its history. So it's really a when, not if question. And I think, you know, so we can do both, but we, you know, of course, need to do it. The sense of urgency is that I want to do it before some other calamity does occur.
Sure. No, that makes a lot of sense. And I think a lot of people also instinctively feel, you know, it's not simply things that will make us extinct or kill lots of us, but, you know, even the potential for incredible social disorder, which just makes it impossible to make these kinds of investments, could make it much more difficult in the future. So,
we depend on national space programs and a little bit of the private sector more recently, but there's no guarantee that they'll stay at their step of progress. Now, there's a little bit of competition between India, China, the US, the ESA, JAXA, all trying to get to the moon and Mars faster, which is great. But you know that we don't know if that'll always be the case.
Yeah. So one more sort of ethically related question, which, you know, a point you and others have made is that as far as we know, you know, we're the only life in the universe that we've seen, you know, certainly the only intelligent life that we're aware of. But if we discover other intelligent life in the universe, does that alter how we should think about this as a moral imperative?
I think hopefully it would just extend it. So in this case, or even if we make an AI that's, you know, self-aware and intelligent, mm-hmm. the same thing could apply here. If there's a new intelligence that appears here that's distinct from humans, or even if octopuses just keep getting smarter and they become, mm-hmm. it could be anybody, right? So the part in the book I talk about, maybe we send a bunch of smart octopuses to other ocean worlds and let them hang out for a few million years and see what they turn into. I think it extends it. So this sense of the duty towards life applies to all life whenever it's aware of extinction or it can act on behalf of life to preserve life. I think it is incumbent upon whatever that life form is to carry this duty.
Right. So the uniqueness makes this more acute, but it is not essential for it to be something important.
Correct. Yeah, it could be. Yeah. I'm actually hoping that we meet other intelligent life that has that is, you know, friendly. But that's the biggest, you know, concern in books like the three body problem or other. Most people are afraid of aliens because we don't know what we're going to find out there. Maybe they are, you know, harvesting resources from every planet is often a, you know, science fiction or movies. They're often antagonists to humans, but they could just be nice people as well. We don't know. But I think it's very inward looking because humans have been historically pretty awful explorers whenever they come across other humans. But I think we've evolved since then a bit. So hopefully it'll be better. Maybe the other intelligences also had to go through a multi-step of evolving how they view other creatures.
Right. I look forward to the field of astrosociology expanding and developing. But not where we are in this interview. So let's move on now to the how. Can you provide us with a broad overview of the phases of your plan for becoming multiplanetary? Obviously, this is the core of the book, and we're not going to be able to cover everything, but a broad outline to help people enter into the book would be great.
Happy to. So yeah, it's written in 10 different phases, and I'll just do kind of highlights in general sections. The first phase technically ended in 2020 because I wrote a lot of these ideas down in 2010, is that we would learn a lot more about the human genome. The phases of, say, 2020 onward are more about astronaut studies, learning more about beginning of, you know, tools of synthetic biology and genome engineering. Once we get to the 2040s, it was actually longer term trials and multi-generational clinical trials and doing more astronaut studies, which we're doing as we speak. So we're sending humans on longer missions, doing continued monitoring and profiling of those crews. And then it gets more vague as you go farther, you know, farther out from Earth and further into the book. Is, you know, we, you know, in the near the 2100s, getting into phase, you know, three and four, that's when we start starting getting samples back and forth between the planets in our solar system. I imagine we'll have even organisms that could potentially survive on Titan by the time we get to phase five. So a lot of phase four, five, and six is getting to be more routinely moving through our solar system and doing more extensive genetic editing to get organisms that can survive on these planets and moons. And then my hope is that actually by we've learned lessons from other extremophiles on Earth and then apply them by the ages of, I mean, phase seven and eight is actually then we're at a stage where we can begin to start to look at other solar systems. And by the end of basically 2400, we will have mapped, we've already mapped several thousand exoplanets, but by that time, we're estimated to have probably millions of exoplanets discovered and probably thousands or tens of thousands of them that are in the potentially habitable zone. So by the end of really phase nine is the hope that we then are ready to send, basically at the end of about 500 years, is to send a generation ship of people that have been prepared and are able to survive on a journey to get to another star system, exoplanet, and survive there or move to another one. And phase 10 is a lot about the end of the universe. How long do we do this? Do we go to other stars? Right. We're about the heat death of the universe. It's really the end of the universe. But in a broad nutshell, that's kind of the bigger strokes. And it goes through step by step, though. It's a book of nonfiction. It's everything that we know works today that could be implemented to create cells, to create organisms, to create microbes that have new capacity, that have different genetic code, different adaptability. Again, taking lessons from things we know that we have working in my lab at Cornell or that we know have happened already in life.
And how hard do you think it is to actually predict what's going to happen with technology? I mean, it makes a lot of sense. You sort of start off with things that are, you know, simply an extension of what we're doing now, what you're working on, and then we get to much more complicated stuff that, you know, we're not sure if we're, or at least I guess maybe I'm not sure if we're going to be able to get to. How confident are you in sort of the kind of technological progress? Or, you know, I mean, you're doing the best with what you have. Maybe you're not that confident, but you're doing your best to predict it. So how do you think about that?
Of course, it's harder. There's an old saying that the best way to predict the future is to create it. You know, whenever possible, we try to make the cells I describe in the book, or create the new organisms or the new genetic constructs, you know, literally in my lab. So some of the things I can have some agency over. But a lot of it is, you know, it does get more vague as you look farther into the future. And it'll be, but I think there's been a continued progression of some things that we've seen again and again in genetics that I think, if anything, will just probably occur faster than we thought. Like, for example, 20 years ago, there were ways to modify and edit genomes, what are called zinc finger nucleases or TALENs, these tail effector nucleases. There's different ways to swap out genetic code, start to create new constructs. But everyone, they were moving slowly. So it was thought it would take decades of work. But then CRISPR enabled us to do larger and faster and more complex editing and really accelerated that progress much faster than most people thought. And so I think we'll see, you know, a lot of the ideas in the book of saying hybrid creatures, say taking genetic elements from tardigrades or creatures or extremophiles, seems difficult now in terms of how you do it. And I describe in the book technically how. But it may, you know, there may be technologies that make it easier. So suddenly this idea of almost like the way you would move a plug from one outlet of your house to another, no one thinks about that at all, because it's just the system is built to be interoperable. And we may, you know, for example, make an easier version of this for different genes and different creatures, or even synthesis of DNA from scratch. Right now is really expensive and slow, but maybe that'll get cheaper and faster, or probably it will. So I think I laid out a foundation of things that are anchored in technology of today, and I think, and made a reasonable projection of their progress. But if anything, it might go faster in some cases, but some things might go slower, like fusion. In theory, we might have, you know, fusion at some point, probably not cold fusion, but fusion is already, you know, at least been one reaction that has created more energy than went into it. So some of the Tomahawk and other kind of types, those kinds of reactors are exciting. And so at some point we could apply that to propulsion. I don't assume that we make progress in propulsion in the book, just to be conservative. It's like, you know, maybe it's harder than we think, or it takes longer. I think in thousands and tens of thousands of years, I think we'll get there, but probably not necessarily in the next few hundred years. So in some cases, I was more conservative, and some of it's in propulsion, because I think we might get it to work, but it's going to be very hard to get that to be in a small, tiny little engine. I think a fusion engine, again, not impossible in the long, long run, but in the short term, so I was more conservative on some things.
Something that came through to me in the book is that you see a moral obligation to engage in genetic engineering of humans. And I think the case you put forward makes a lot of sense, but that is in tension, in some cases in opposition, to what many other scientists and broader society says. So what has been the reaction to your position on this and to the book more broadly?
It's been mostly positive, actually, because as I put in the book, it's not broad and random and wanton genetic engineering of humans. It's under the context of what we do already today at the hospital, is under the real, you know, controlled environment of clinical trials with informed consent, with a clear medical need. So those are, three big parameters that make it so not only is it desirable or ethical, but even required. So the two examples I give in the book, specifically of when you may be ethically bound, you know, if someone has a disease and you can treat it today, for example, there's treatments I talk about in the book where you can modify the genetic code of a person with sickle cell disease to take the disease away by literally genetically editing the patient, or T-cell therapies I talk about. So there's things that are happening today that treat a clear medical need. But the problem is, there's two other cases where I think you could argue a severe disease is one. But in the book, I talk explicitly about if you have a couple that has, you know, two different copies of the gene, there's a mutation, and they want to have a child, but there's literally no way based on the genetics. So there's a case where you could say, well, you could either tell the couple, well, you know, tough luck. We have a means to correct your genetic code, but you have to adopt. We're not going to let you do that. I think would be unethical, because we have a technology, again, assuming it's safe and effective. That's a case where you could enable someone to have a healthy child, and not doing it, I think, would be unethical. The other case that is more relevant for the book is, if you're sending someone to a faraway planet with lots of risk and radiation and danger, you know, if you have a genetic means to keep them safe, which is the genetic protections are well validated, they're safe, they're effective. The benefit outweighs the risk. If that's the case, then you would be morally bound to protect them and to use the latest in medicine to keep them safe, keep them alive, even on some of these worlds where it'd be more difficult. So that's the case where, and again, that assuming you don't have a spacesuit that protects you or other technology. I mean, genetic engineering of humans is probably the most complicated way to protect someone on a faraway planet, because you probably want to build machines or construct that would also do this. But it is something I put forward that you have to at least consider as the technology advances, which it already has clinically, I'd say.
Yeah, I mean, I think you do a nice job of making the case that we're sort of already edging into this. Most people, are comfortable for bringing folks up, especially for very dangerous diseases, but even bring people to a baseline of, from not being able to see to being able to see.
But there are some people, that say we should put a moratorium on anything for germline editing because we just don't know enough. And I think, I describe a bit in the book that we do need probably intergenerational clinical trials, or which is part of the original plan anyways. If we start doing any of these kinds of significant modifications, we have to look not just at one person and one life, but even their children, especially germline editing, meaning you're changing the egg and sperm, but use it. You're fundamentally changing the genetic code of humanity, which is a monumental task. But the reaction's been mostly intrigued. Actually, Jim Green was the former chief scientist at NASA. He was giving a talk about a year ago and said, Chris Mason's in the audience and he's genetically editing and modifying astronauts. And I was like, whoa, not yet. We're talking about it, but we haven't started doing it yet. And it might be 10 or 20 or 30 years from now. But so some people have somehow thought I'm already doing this, but it's not the case. And I talked to him afterwards, he's a good friend. But the, I said, no, we're not yet. We're talking about it. It hasn't happened yet. So I think the under the framework of, as we do for most clinical work, well-controlled environments, you start with a small cohort, you see how it goes. We wouldn't just do it fast and broad and wantonly.
I mean, I don't want to go down too much of a transhumanist tangent, but think about, sort of human enhancement, right? So, I mean, even putting aside space, it could be useful for farmers, say, to be able to see in near IR, that's something that could potentially be done. How do we move beyond a requirements-based framework for this to
enhancement
choice-based framework? Yeah, enhancement.
Yeah, and there, for example, also in planets that are far away from their sun, in our solar system or other ones, being able to see in low light or IR would be great. So the could be terrestrial applications, could be applications on other planets, moons. So I think, and those are cases where you could argue there's a real clear need, genetic modifications, but I also describe ways you can do epigenetic modifications. So instead of changing the genetic code, you can just change when and how it's activated or repressed. Mm-hmm. And this is something that we have working in lab routinely now as a way to kind of flip like a light switch, turn on the genes when you need them or turn them off when you don't need them. It's something that we can do. And that gives it's a bit more of a palatable, I think, option for people. The best example is the treatment for sickle cell disease. Mm-hmm. Is in that case, the CRISPR therapy actually just gets rid of a little enhancer that is stopping fetal hemoglobin. So the sickle cell carriers have a problem with their hemoglobin, which carries oxygen through their blood. Mm-hmm. Basically makes these sickle cell red blood cells that clot. But if you just turn back on the gene that used to be on when you're younger, when you were a fetus, then that's a way to cure the disease. And so I think you could imagine doing other treatments like that as well. That if you just need your genes for the weekend to turn them on for a little while, something like that, which is interesting to think about. But so I think those are both options that people should consider.
Yeah. So I'd say this conversation is quite timely with the recent release of the National Academy's decadal survey, Thriving in Space, that also looked at the role of the biological sciences for space exploration. What did you think of that report and how well does it align with what you're advocating for?
It aligns very well. I was actually one of the authors of the report. So I'm one of the several. So I knew it well. I've been working on it for 2 years. We just submitted it to Congress. It was myself as well as about 15 others. So it was a group effort. But we met and deliberated over a few years to think, what should NASA do for the next 10 years? It was, in the title of it, I think, says a lot. It's not that we don't just want to get to space and happen to kind of be there. We want to thrive there. And so we've had more than 20 years of continuous presence in space in the ISS. The current ISS will be eventually decommissioned probably by 2030, maybe a little longer. But what's exciting is there'll be probably four space stations that might come up and replace it, and others are being planned. And so we might have like a little, almost like different hotels in space. You can go there if you want to. And so, and then when they're there, what are they doing up there? Is there, you know, industries? Are there commercial applications? Are there research questions, of course, that can be done? And, you know, all those things and more can be done. And then eventually we talked about the moon and Mars, and really not just getting to the moon, but staying there permanently and a lunar base. So all these are active and being, you know, active projects at NASA and other space agencies and being driven at. So I think the report is phenomenal, but in the sense of like, I think it aligns well, but, and I shouldn't call it phenomenal, I helped write it, but I like it because I helped write it. But it's phenomenal that it includes, I think, the same enthusiasm for not just getting there, but thriving in space. And it does talk about ways to look at genetic modifications briefly, or ways to consider any tools and technologies that can monitor the crews and keep them safe.
I mean, one of the things I found interesting as I read it is the tone is quite different from the other decadal surveys. And I would even perhaps say it comes off as more opinionated.
I'm very curious with it. It is. We also didn't pull punches. Like a lot of times people say NASA should get a little bit more funding. We said it needs 10 times the amount of money. Like if you're going to really get to the moon and Mars in the next 10 years, it's not a 20% budget increase. It's laughable, right? So, and that's what, and so we kind of did that on purpose, because if we say 10 times, maybe there'll be two times, right? So, you know, like it's a bit of a negotiation with Congress in a sense. But yeah, I'm curious. I'd love to hear.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly where my next question was going. No other report said anything like the direct quote is the BPS, the Biological and Physical Sciences budget, must rise by a factor of 10 well before the end of the decade.
Yes.
You know, unfortunately, it doesn't seem like we're on the path for that, but
for the government has some issues, but but
maybe, just to be clear for the audience, we are recording this on the 27th of September. You know, it is very unclear if there's going to be a government shutdown in the next few days, you know, or in the next week. By the time you hear this, we will probably have an answer to that. But that is the context for this conversation. But more broadly, why do you think this particular area has been so underfunded? And what do you think of the prospects for the investments recommended being made? You sort of started to address that, but let's go deeper on that.
Historically, it's shuffled around a bit. Some of it was, you know, every time there's a restructuring at NASA, they only have so much money to move around. And so it's been shuffled around depending on mission needs, or, you know, because the NASA budget includes everything. It's everything for work out in the outer solar system, supporting Voyager probes, supporting planetary science, earth science, and atmospheric monitoring, the sun, you know, it includes heliophysics. It's big, right? So BPS, like the biological physical sciences, can get shuffled around depending on if there's a big mission that's in a different division that eats up a lot of the cash. And so some of it's just the vagaries and shifting sands of priorities in any given fiscal year or two and big missions. But it's been, I think it's been somewhat just because it hasn't been deemed as a priority, some because we've had, haven't had that many people going to space that often. But I think two big things will change, I think, in this next decade, and they're related, is that one of the other strong recommendations we put in there, which I was very adamant on, is continued and expanded collaboration with the commercial sector, which is which will fundamentally change how we do spaceflight. Already has to a large degree. Because the second thing is not just that the commercial sector is there, which is great, the space stations, the Starship, for example, with SpaceX. But then assuming they're successful in the next few years, once Starship is going, it might be two, 3 years, but definitely probably not more than 5 years. 100 people at a time will go up in a Starship, as many as 100, could be 50 at a time, at least 12 for every single mission. So that means within a year of the operational Starship, we could surpass the totality of everyone who's ever been to space. If they launch 7 missions in a year, that's it. You're 700 people, and there's only been about 607 or so to date. So suddenly you can have an orders of magnitude increase in the number of humans. And that was part of what we assume will happen in this next decade and put in the report, is that we have to be ready for that. We have to understand, you know, the kinetics of the body in space, the risk factors, living in space, eating in space, all the food production, all that has to be built, actually. So there's little bits of it created, but most of it we have not made yet. So that was why we really pushed for it.
Yeah. So, I mean, right now, most space-related science is funded by NASA and other government agencies. what do you think the roles of philanthropic, private, and government capital should be going forward, and how might that change over time?
Good question. There, I want more of all of it, I guess, is the short answer, of course, because I'm working in space genetics and space medicine and space biology. But we've, even just in my own lab and as an exemplar, we do get funding from NASA and space agencies, but it's maybe 40% of the funding is actually directly from the government, either from NASA or NIH in a related project. Mm-hmm. Probably the majority, about 60, and some is from collaborations. We have one industry collaborator who wants to make a radio protective molecule, so working with them as an industry partner. So I think industry can sometimes come up with something that's helpful, say, for cancer, and then sponsor research at labs and with investigators to see if it has applications for spaceflight, which I think is fascinating. But that's, I think, only going to be 10 or 20% on the commercial support of research. Commercial entities usually want to make money, not spend money on specific projects. And every company is different. Some companies spend 2% on R&D, some spend 20%, really depends. But then the majority, though, like say 50, 60% any given year is actually philanthropically driven, at least in my own lab at Cornell, where we have donors who really love space or see the value of this as a new frontier, or just are passionate about humanity and thinking about us reaching the stars. So I've seen philanthropy, I think, already plays a big role, and I think could be, probably one of the bigger roles. An example like the Starshot initiative is to try and get a little light sail to Alpha Centauri and send data back. And that's currently all private money. That's, or at least it's not that much money behind it yet, but none of it's got from the government, which is interesting.
And so how does the philanthropic spending come about? Is it just sort of somebody who sort of thinks the government is investing enough, I can get incrementally, more space science done, or I have a different risk profile? Sort of what is it that they do that the other folks don't?
Yeah, they're, what's great is a lot of the private capital or philanthropic money that goes into the space sector is more flexible. They can take bigger bets and longer bets and understand if you need to change direction a bit more readily on a project, whereas usually grants from the government or other foundations might be more tightly constrained. Like you have to do exactly this project over, get 1 or 2 years to do it. Some of them are bigger and longer bets. So it's 5-10 year projects, sometimes longer. The Starshot initiative, for example, it would be over a much longer, be over 40, 50 years. And so I think you get, advantages there, for big ideas that will take a long time to prove out or even to not work. Take bigger risks.
How do you think we should think about international cooperation versus competition? So in your book, you cite a lot of research from China. I'm always torn on this because obviously we could accomplish more leveraging each other's resources. But the reality is a lot of funding comes from a sense of competition with China. Mm-hmm. So how do you think about this?
Yeah, it's kind of the second space race, you could say, because it was really China. Sorry, U.S. and Russia for the first space race. I think we're entering a new space race, but it's not just bidirectional. It is between the U.S. and China for sure. And that does help with people's motivation. And competition is a great motivator for sure. And I think what's interesting, though, is it's also, we have India's actually trying to even beat both China and the U.S. to get to Mars. I don't know if they will, but the race is on, which I think will help spur innovation. And I would like to see as much collaboration as possible, at least on the measurements of, say, for example, crews, the data collected, the knowledge base of humanity to increase. Because if you silo all the information just in one country, not everyone can benefit from it. And I would much rather see, collaboration in what's often called the pre-competitive space. This happens in the U.S., for example. You can have multiple pharmaceutical companies trying to do precision medicine. They say, okay, we need to design our drugs to match with the best drug, the best patient. But something that is ahead of that, a pre-competitive, is we just need to do the sequencing of the genome correctly. We need to make sure we have the DNA of the patient properly analyzed. And so there's meetings where people get together and they say, okay, but what our goal is to be the best in the market with our drug. But before we get there, we need to have the best anchor in medicine first. And that's a place where they can all come together and work together. And so I think we don't yet have, we've never really had in space medicine or in space engineering, rocketry. There's not ever been a built pre-competitive space, sort of the United Nations maybe, but we haven't had that occur yet. And I think it would be great to have happen, but it historically has actually never happened. To your point of what's the history of it, for example, the twin study that we did with Mark and Scott Kelly, there was also a cosmonaut going up there for 1 year at the same time. And the original goal with NASA and Roscosmos was to share data, molecular data, clinical data, flight recordings. They ended up sharing none of it. So it broke down, you know, even before what happened in Crimea and Ukraine. It just didn't work. And the quote I heard from someone at NASA was, even if we got the data from the Russians, we wouldn't trust it and wouldn't use it because we don't know how they collected it. They didn't get any details. So there has to be some degree of trust. And I think it probably has to occur in some defined pre-competitive space, which would probably be terrestrial medicine applications, I think. Not yet. Yeah. I hope.
And perhaps that's sort of a opportunity space for some, you know, nonprofit or international organization to be a repository for that data.
Well, funny you should ask. We just started one called BioAstra, which is a nonprofit for that very reason, because simply born out of frustration. Like, I want to know just a simple question. I'm designing a new experiment that's going to fly in space. Has this flown before? Has it already been approved and gone through the process to get something ready for space? It's a complicated process. If someone's already gotten it up there and working in a protocol and a piece of hardware, great. We should try and use that or build from that. It's the same thing you do. It's what the patent system does, basically. When you have an idea, you can see what has been invented and you can build on that. That's the whole thing. In the United States Constitution is to build on the patent system. But a lot of spaceflight hardware, you have no idea who flew it or when they flew it. There's no place to even find it all, right? So, and most people don't submit patents on their new space hardware. It's just a small market, right? So at least today it is. So we're trying to build up a repository of every protocol, piece of hardware, any other paperwork that enabled some of the space flight to work for different biological and clinical experiments. So every drug that's flown in space, that was also something that was redacted for a while, but now we have that, for example. So yeah, we're getting there, and just made a nonprofit to do the thing. So hopefully it'll be successful.
That's very exciting. So going into some different directions, what do you think the significance of finding bacterial or other non-intelligent life within our solar system would be? How should we think about the potential scientific value of that discovery? And how do you think the public would react to, you know, on Europa, there's little wiggly things underneath the ice
moving around and maybe waving at us, or, you know, reading the New York Times or whatever they're doing, little wiggly guys. I think there, and so this actually also links to the question of, you know, BioAstra, I mentioned, also want to mention my co-founders, Savi Glow and Ellie Overby, to get the nonprofit up and running. Is the sharing all the data is not just human data, or it's anything. If you see a microbe on the space station, you sequence the genome of it, you see a microbe in theory, what if we find it on Mars? Like, this is really, I think, to the benefit of all humanity, if we find it, and should be accessible to everybody. We would usually publish most of our strains from the ISS as soon as we can. But if it's on another planet, it will, I think there'll be a bit of an unsettling moment for humanity at first, but I think more exciting, because that means if there's other life out there, even if it's microbial, that means we can go find more of it on other exoplanets. I think it would hopefully lead to a renaissance in understanding, and then also in excitement and opportunity to go find more life, go characterize that life. How did it evolve? How long has it been there? So I think it would be, it would have biblical implications, of course, because there's nothing about the life on other planets, like in the Bible or the Quran. The Torah, but I think there it would, you know, so it would unsettle some people, but it would be exciting, I think, overall. We would suddenly say, oh, we're not alone. We think we have friends, but we have to go find them and see if they're friends or the enemies, they're frenemies, you know. So I think, and if they're microbial, that's easy. But it would also raise questions of planetary protection. Then which we have for coming back in the 2030s, these samples will come back from Mars, from the Mars sample return mission. What if you bring back something that could kill all of humanity, a microbe that's like a superbug? It's Michael Crichton wrote a book called The Andromeda Strain about this very idea. Mm-hmm. Hopefully that doesn't happen, but also the inverse could happen. What if we go there and bring bugs and it kills all those species, right? So we'll have to do this slowly, carefully, and constrain how we would, if we find life, go play with it, learn from it, and characterize it, and vice versa, and not kill ourselves when we're doing it.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about your background. How did you get interested in the intersection of biological sciences and space exploration? And, you know, how did you get to where you are right now?
So I start when I was a kid. I went to space camp when I was a kid. So I've always been excited about space, and maybe being an astronaut or going
Alabama or Florida.
Huntsville, Alabama. Yeah, that's right.
My son went there last summer as well.
Oh, great. Yeah, did he like it? He did.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great time. And actually, my nephew just went this past summer, actually, and he loved it as well. So it's, you know, I've always, loved astronomy and loved science as a kid. And so would read books about it, think about it. And I knew I really wanted to be a geneticist though in middle school, because I was fascinated with the fact that we all start as a single cell, and all the instructions to make every cell type in our body and our brains and all the seat of our cognition, it's all encoded in that one cell. And at the time when I was a kid, we didn't even have the human genome yet sequenced. We didn't even know what the book of life was. But now that we have the genetic code, we are still trying to understand it and even manipulate it and control it and improve it in some cases to get rid of disease. But it's a wonderfully complex entity. And so those are probably my two biggest loves scientifically is space and genetics. And it was very easy to put them together because I've been thinking about them since I was like four, I guess. So really young, and read a lot of books and, read other things like Isaac Asimov, the Foundation series, mm-hmm. which also I think sparked in my head this concept that it was viewed as axiomatic and obvious that of course humans could be on many, many planets across a galaxy. And it was written as so matter of fact in that book that it captivated my imagination that this could happen. And I think even that then eventually led to arguments of why it should happen.
Okay. So we've gotten the spark inside of you, but how do we go from a kid dreaming about doing genetics and space to actually combining these things and getting opportunities in practice?
Yes. I did the usual things. You go to school, study hard, get good grades. I did my undergrad in Madison, Wisconsin, originally from Wisconsin. And that was in genetics. Did my PhD at Yale, also in genetics, and worked a lot on fruit flies and early modifications of genomes. And then did a clinical fellowship, though, also for my postdoctoral work to learn about the human body, clinical responses, what drives human disease and how it can go awry. And then started my lab at Cornell, kind of built on those pillars of the computational methods, the clinical genetics, and then some of the engineering biology ideas. And I've been at Cornell since 2009. What's great is they enabled a laboratory of about 30 people that can, we have ideas and brainstorming, and then we can go to lab and work on them. And so it's really, I'd say, a playground of a lot of these ideas, which I'm very fortunate to have.
And then do you sort of reach out to NASA and say, hey, I think we could do something interesting? Do you, cold call Elon Musk? How do you go from sort of the more standard stuff to, getting it connected with space community?
Yes. So we, I don't cold call, not yet. Maybe Elon might need something from me at some point. But no, he's, on some of the calls I've been on, but never any like no taking shots at the bar late into the night with Elon or anything, but the SpaceX medical operations team, we've worked with them very closely for the past 3 years. And some of the very first missions, like the Inspiration 4 mission, they've been phenomenal to work with there. And also some of the technical teams, we have a bunch of manuscripts and papers in review as well from early work there, and continuing to work with SpaceX, which is really ramping up a lot of its spaceflight program as well as the rockets. And NASA, sometimes the director of the human research program, just send him an email, or we hop on the phone to say, oh, here's some ideas. Let's walk through them, because I've been working with them since early days of the twin study or even missions before then, and know them and their colleagues. And so it's good to be able to call them up and say, here's some thoughts and ideas and walk through them. And so sometimes that leads to an announcement and say, okay, we have a solicitation for a grant. That's kind of what happened with the twin study. Was I talking to NASA about doing large genetic studies of astronauts before they went up in space, and they didn't really have a program that did that till the twin study. So sometimes it takes a little while to germinate into an actual project, but it's very collaborative. And so I think, and very open, which I think is, as it should be.
And you have already referenced some institutions that you're building to try and address many elements of the 500-year plan. Can you just connect the threads for us? What are all the elements of that, and what's the progress on each of them?
Yeah, so several elements. I think, and just for clarification, I will almost certainly be dead for the vast majority of this plan, but it is, it's not for me to live for 500 years, but that the plan is updated, modified, and is carried forward. So some of them are building an anchor at Cornell, something that can be handed on to the next generation, which is getting funding, getting endowments for different projects and grants, including this one, spaceflight research. And building actually an aerospace medicine biobank, which holds the samples as well as the data from astronauts who've flown that we can then have other people share and benefit from that information. So that includes clinical support, like infrastructure at a lab in a hospital to store these samples, process the data, enable a way to access the data has all been built up. I mentioned the nonprofit BioAstro to get a pre-competitive space for people to share and all benefit from the knowledge and the data and best practices, basically. And then also, you know, working a bit, for example, with, you know, other agencies or other investigators who are sending samples to, or, you know, missions to like the Europa to look for signs of life, Jonathan Lunin, who's the chair of astronomy at Cornell, and chatting with him and, you know, coordinating, like, if we see signs of life, what would that look like? And chatting with them and, you know, building, again, building most things, though, to assume we have a well-organized, well-curated data set and tools and methods that we can build upon and then hand on to the next generation and can keep iterating and building on. And including actually Avi Loeb, for example, is looking for interstellar probes, basically. And so, you know, working with the Galileo project there as well. So a lot of it is connecting with people who are doing either directly related or tangentially related work in space and thinking about humans exploring space.
Your latest book is The Age of Prediction. Can you tell us anything about that and how the tools you described there might be applied to space science and development?
Yes. So there we actually talk a bit about AI, of course, which is everyone on everyone's mind these days. And where is it used and how are predictive algorithms deployed? You know, one of the places they're actually deployed is a lot of machine learning models to scan the sky for asteroids that could hit the Earth. Mm-hmm. There's a whole program at NASA for this, but we talk about it in medicine and finance and warfare and society. So we have the lessons from the book. We apply them in many areas. And it's, you know, we want to see AI ideally as a force of good in the universe, because it could be bad, but it's like any technology can be either a tool or a weapon, depending on what you do with it. So AI is no different. Predictive algorithms are no different. This is what we wrote about in the book, is that they change the risk calculation or the uncertainty, but they are sometimes a tool, sometimes a weapon. And we have to know that it can be both, I think, and build predictive algorithms to be ideally helpful. So for example, scanning the sky for asteroids using machine learning tools, building new classifiers to diagnose disease, it heavily depends on AI algorithms. There's a worry that AI might become self-aware and then maybe attack us, but there are many other intelligences on Earth already that are aware of us and don't attack us. And even other humans, most humans don't just randomly attack other humans and view them as a threat that they have to be all destroyed. But so I'm hopeful that if it really is an AI that's smart enough, it'll either work with us, maybe even serve as better shepherds of life, to carrying on that duty question earlier, or they could kill us all. That is possible. But I think, you know, we don't think that if we see, for example, an ant on the street, that we want to kill all ants. If they're in our way, we might get rid of them. But there's no one pushing to kill all ants. And I don't think we'd see that with an AI. If it's really that smart, we would probably not be that big of a threat to them. I think that worry is probably self-reflective, is that humans have had such a awful history of exploration and genocide. The worry is that whatever we would create would do the same to us. But I don't think it has to be if you program it right.
Yeah. Well, do you have any sort of final thoughts or things you think we should cover before we break? Any final things for our audience?
You know, I think that I try to embed in the book a bit of optimism and hope that I think people should, you know, again, any technology could be good or bad, and it's not inherently, you know, one or the other. You know, one of the best examples is just like facial recognition software does a poorer job on blacks than white people. And people say, you know, but that means it's not the algorithm that did it wrong. It's the training data that it represents the racism, right? So I think if you feed a bunch of the training data and you don't give enough of a subset, it won't do as good of a job, right? So there are ways we can be more aware of the tools that we create and improve them and have them be more accessible, more equitable, more useful, frankly. And so I think a lot of the technology is very exciting, but I think we have to deploy it with a sense of humanity as well. How can we make it useful for as many people as possible, accessible, and also just actually help us get to the stars and look for places where everyone can benefit. But it's also easy to think in a utopian view because everything costs money and time and energy. But it is something that, you know, there's been examples we've worked together before, like getting rid of the ozone hole over Antarctica was a globally recognized threat, and we addressed it and came together and solved it. And I think there's evidence in our history that we can work together and should just do that again. And so I hope to see more of it.
That's a perfect note to end on. Dr. Mason, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure.
Thank you to Dr. Mason for joining the Multiplanetary Society podcast. And thanks to all of our listeners. If you like this content, please make sure to subscribe on your favorite podcasting platform to ensure you don't miss an episode, and leave a review to help other people find it. If you have any feedback or guest suggestions, feel free to email us at multiplanetarysociety, all one word with no dashes, @gmail.com. We look forward to having you join us for the next episode.